I'm Pat Duggins, news director at Alabama Public Radio. The following program contains content of an adult nature. Parents may want to consider whether it's appropriate for younger listeners.
My friend Becca took me to the hospital, but I hadn't told the hospital what had just happened to me.
Dixie Shannon lives in central Alabama.
We just kind of blindly, I just was going along with going there. And the hospital recognized me as a trafficked victim. And they asked me, ma'am, have you been trafficked? Are you being trafficked currently? And I just remember breaking into tears and just crying. And like, just finally somebody had a name for it. Somebody had a name for the torment that I had just been through.
It happened twice. First when she was 17, and again in her mid-20s. Each time, Shannon says her trafficker acted like he was on her side, at least at first. She recalls the second time around.
This guy was going to give me some security. He was going to put me in a hotel room. I was going to take a shower. I just needed to eat. And he did. He did all of that. He brought me into a hotel room and he took care of me. And he was like, this is what I want from you. And I was just like, okay.
The phrase, what I want from you, is one you hear a lot from survivors of human trafficking. It's like a code that means you're about to enter the life. That's code two. For the world of commercial sex.
I ended up doing so much drugs because he was requiring me to do so much. I couldn't take a shower without making a certain amount of money. I couldn't eat. I couldn't do anything. Couldn't rest. I couldn't talk to my kids, nothing. And I couldn't do anything. And I ended up, getting to a point where I was like, I'm going to either kill myself because I'm going to overdose on these drugs, or he's going to kill me.
What Dixie Shannon described is something APR News heard a lot about. For some of the survivors we spoke with, their trafficker started out as a stranger.
He drugged me, and I woke up in a hotel room naked on a bed and had no idea how I got there or when or anything.
For others in Alabama, their trafficker was a member of their family.
You might have a mom that, the only way she can keep her house or her wherever she's staying is to let her landlord have sexual access to her kid. That sort of thing happens quite a bit.
Human trafficking isn't limited to just women. Both men and boys are abused, as well as members of Alabama's LGBTQ community.
Most of our kids identify as bisexual, and that's because they've been sold to this person or that person, males and females, so they really don't know what their gender is.
The APR News team spent 14 months and over 3,000 miles on the road investigating human trafficking in Alabama. That includes sex trafficking, but also labor trafficking, where victims are forced to work for low pay and poor living conditions. We'll address both. We'll also hear about the psychological games traffickers use to ensnare their victims.
They pick up on that. It's almost like they are honed into that. So, me being already abused as a child, I had a lot of insecurities. I was an introvert. So, they picked up on that.
APR News also heard from cybercrime analysts in Birmingham who study sex traffickers when they advertise on the internet in Alabama. This data can track sex workers who live in the state and those who travel here like a caravan.
So if I can find five girls who are all in Atlanta on Monday and Birmingham on Tuesday and Chattanooga on Wednesday, but all five girls are in those cities on those days, that's usually something that we would consider an indicator of trafficking.
And for those who choose to buy these illegal services... APR News spent the night on an undercover sting operation with the West Alabama Human Trafficking Task Force. And we'll look at the mindsets regarding human trafficking, like how the Deep South handles the issue compared to people in the Midwest.
In the Midwest, it's very much like, let's fix that. What can I do about that? In the South, it's very much like, oh, I wish you had not told me about that. Oh, I did not want to know that.
But the fact is that Unfortunately, there is a prevalence of human trafficking throughout the entire state.
That's Christian Lim. He's leading a project at the University of Alabama's College of Social Work on human trafficking in the state. His team spent 2017 conducting interviews around Alabama to get a snapshot of how many suspected victims of trafficking ask for help from the police or social service agencies. Lim says the final number was nearly 1,200. And that's not the disquieting part.
Yeah, clearly whatever we're recovering is a smaller percentage of what's happening.
So small, Lim says, that some estimates put the real figure at 10 times higher. If that's true, then the total could be closer to 12,000, just in Alabama, just in 2017. Lim says the point is that authorities know what they know, but that's it.
So if you flip that on its head, what that means is there's a lot of professionals in our state that are running across victims of human trafficking, but not identifying it and seeing them as victims of human trafficking.
But the College of Social Work found another number that could give an even clearer picture of trafficking in Alabama. It's based on when traffickers come out in the open and advertise on the internet. 2 years ago, the college counted those ads, and the total was 641,000, just in Alabama, just in 2017.
The biggest problem with getting a realistic number is the people who are most likely to encounter this activity are the participants.
That's Gary Warner. He's a computer analyst in Birmingham. He's referring specifically to the buyers and sellers of sex trafficking in Alabama, better known as the Johns and the Pimps.
And both of them are, you know, not likely to report the situation.
At least not voluntarily, and that's where Warner comes in. If you look at trafficking like a business, you have sellers, you have buyers, and you have merchandise, which in this case happens to be people. Warner spends his workday going to where the deals are made.
If we go down further, it says, "Hey, Daddy, if you're looking for," and that's about all we are able to say about this ad on the radio. But if you want to have a great time, contact me, and it lists the telephone number again.
Warner sits in front of a large computer screen. It's cluttered with online ads in Birmingham featuring pictures of young women. Some are unclothed, others are performing sex acts. And many of these messages get specific.
And in this case, you know, she describes many different sex acts she'll perform. And then the prices go as low as $10 for these services, up to $100 if you want her to spend the night with you.
The ads on Warner's computer screen are basic. No flashy videos or graphics, just a photo and a price list. None of these ads gives details on what this person may be going through.
I was forced to stay in a hotel room. So I basically lived in a box for a year.
That's Dixie Shannon. She lives in central Alabama. Shannon isn't in any of the sex ads on Warner's computer screen, but the experience she shared with APR showed what it was like to be trafficked. Shannon says it didn't start with Johns with handfuls of cash. Her trafficker had a process first. It's referred to as grooming.
There was many episodes where, you know, like, he would test me many times, and then he would use different forms of punishment. He would break me down until I was nothing, and then he would build me a little bit from that, and then break me down again and keep rebuilding me and breaking me down.
Part of Shannon's grooming process was on how to use internet sex ads to drum up business. She was trafficked twice. First, when Shannon was 17, then again in her mid-20s as she was going through a divorce. Gary Warner isn't alone when it comes to studying sex trafficking ads in Alabama. Outside his office, there's a workroom where analysts sit hunched over their own PCs. One of them arrived late. She had a test in Western Civilizations class. This is the Computer Forensics Research Lab at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. Warner's the director. Outside the lab, other UAB students prepare for their next classes. Inside the lab, Warner's crew works to dredge the seamy underbelly of the internet. Technically, their main client is Facebook, but Warner and his team aren't looking for irritating pop-up ads.
So we do this in the area of terrorism, in opioid and fentanyl trafficking, and we were doing this also in the area of sex trafficking for Facebook.
When it comes to sex trafficking in Alabama, Warner says Alabamians are more likely to use the web to arrange hookups, particularly in larger cities like Mobile, Birmingham, and Huntsville.
I think so, and largely because we don't have the same organized crime structure as some of the larger cities.
and that makes them easier to track. Warner and his team picks a day at random and use their computer tools to look at the commercial sex trade in Birmingham, Mobile, Montgomery, and Huntsville.
In Birmingham, we had 251 ads. In Mobile, we had 114. In Huntsville, we had 106. And in Montgomery, we had 89, which is about 550 ads, roughly, for a single day in four major cities in Alabama, 550 distinctly different advertisements.
560 when you total it up. Alabama is a small and rural location for trafficking compared to, say, Atlanta, which is considered to be a main hub in the southeast. Warner calls up Atlanta's numbers for the same day as Mobile, Montgomery, Birmingham, and Huntsville.
Basically, in an hour, we have 20 ads per hour being posted in Atlanta. That's considerably more than any Alabama city.
But if that hourly rate kept up for the whole day, Atlanta's total would be 480 ads. That's less than the 560 ads for the Alabama cities in Warner's study. The possible takeaway is that Alabama may be small, but not insignificant. It's easy to get the impression that Warner is focused on the numbers. He keeps the good data he finds on sex trafficking and discards the bad. But chasing cyber criminals isn't what got him into this line of work.
I had a daughter who was very troubled, had drug problems and sexual identity problems, went through a really hard time.
As a result, Warner and his wife started supporting the anti-human trafficking group A21, which operates in 14 countries. They found it through their church.
And my daughter said, you know, a lot of girls in a situation like mine, their parents throw them out of their house and they end up getting trafficked. So I'm glad that you guys are supporting that. Well, we lost my daughter a few years after that and kind of personally got involved in fighting human trafficking, kind of in memory of my daughter, to tell the truth.
APR heard similar stories on how runaways end up being trafficked.
You know, I shut down from my family. And everyone that I knew to trust, but I developed a pure 15, 16, 17-year-old normal rebellion as well.
That's Dixie Shannon.
I just got fed up and tired with what I was seeing in my family. I just didn't beat to the drum that they beat to, so I ran away from home.
Within a short time, Shannon was being trafficked. Her first Johns were students at the college in Georgia where her family sent her to work at the age of 17. The National Human Trafficking Hotline quotes a study in Chicago that says 56% of women in the sex trade start off as runaways. This raises a sensitive question. Just because someone is a sex worker, does that automatically mean they're being trafficked? Even support groups for trafficking survivors disagree on this, but Gary Warner doesn't.
Our interpretation, and having talked to many sociologists and criminologists about this, there are very few true volunteer sex workers. Even if you claim you're a volunteer, your economic situation has likely driven you to this point of desperation.
The FBI says a young person in the sex trade is considered a trafficking victim. Adults, however, have to be forced into it through coercion, fraud, or deception. None of the women pictured in the ads Gary Warner showed us appear afraid. He says they don't need to.
There may be some people that are doing it for kicks and money, but usually there's some form of abuse or harm in the past that's caused them to gravitate towards this line of work.
National studies put the average starting age of a sex trafficking victim in the U.S. at between 11 and 15 years old. There, law enforcement says, the notion of choice doesn't enter into it.
Okay, if you will tell them to, we're going to get more food out.
300 people are crowding a packed ballroom at the Embassy Suites in Montgomery, and there's more at issue today than just keeping the coffee pots full. Some in the audience carry badges and have guns on their hips. Others are in business attire, while still more are dressed casually.
Good morning. Can I have your attention, please? We want to go ahead and get started. It's 9 o'clock on the dot.
Today is the 5th annual Alabama Human Trafficking Summit, and everyone in the audience works on some aspect of the subject. The list of speakers includes pretty much something for everyone. That doesn't keep one participant from bringing up one issue on her own.
So I think probably we have more familial trafficking.
That's Teresa Collier. She's with the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency, also known as ALEA. She's considered to be the state's point person on human trafficking. Collier works for ALEA's Fusion Center, which deals in intelligence. That means she spends a lot of time interacting with federal and local law enforcement. Collier also does lots of interviews in the field with victims of human trafficking in Alabama, and she says she's noticed a pattern.
You might have a mom that, you know, the only way she can keep her house or her wherever she's staying is to let her landlord have access, sexual access to her kid. That sort of thing happens quite a bit.
In other words, familial trafficking.
The abuse started for me with him just before my first birthday.
Kelly Dorr is a survivor.
And then it transpired and when I was about 2.5 to 3, where he was allowing other people to abuse me.
With familial trafficking, instead of someone coming in from the outside, a mother or father or an aunt or an uncle is the trafficker and a younger family member is the victim. You've heard from survivors who describe how traffickers preyed on their weaknesses to draw them in. Kelly Dorr says her experience was more direct.
He had threatened over and over that he would kill my mother, he would kill my brother, he would kill my grandparents on my mom's side. And so you go into a protective stage because you know exactly what that perpetrator is going to do to you. You know what they're capable of.
Teresa Collier says she's concerned familial trafficking in Alabama isn't just an issue. It could very well be the issue.
The only reason I say that I feel like there's as much familial pimping is just because of my role as a forensic interviewer, and I know what I have seen.
So I'd say that's likely, of course.
That's Wendy Bradford. She lives in Jackson, Mississippi. Bradford's support of Teresa Collier's position comes with a condition, and it's a big one.
It wouldn't surprise me, but I would probably say what everyone else said to me before we started the project. You've got to have the numbers.
Collier says the project Bradford is referring to is why she considers Mississippi to be pretty much the gold standard when it comes to measuring familial trafficking.
Basically, they took 4 counties in rural Mississippi and they surveyed the Children's Advocacy Centers and other victim service providers just to find out what is the most common type of trafficking you're seeing here, and it was familial.
So we hit the road for Jackson, Mississippi to meet with Bradford.
I was the liaison of the project. I was one of the authors of the project, one of the editors of the project.
The human trafficking group Shared Hope teamed up with Belhaven University. Bradford founded the support group Beautiful Ones Ministry, which also took part. 36 interviews were conducted in the 4 counties surrounding Jackson. Bradford says prosecutors were invited to talk, along with judges, service providers, law enforcement, and governmental agencies.
And so nobody really knew what the problem was. Most people were like, oh, we don't have that here, like most other states or in small towns. Oh, we don't have that here.
But the study said otherwise. Familial trafficking was identified during interviews as the most common form of exploitation, more than gang-related, run-of-the-mill pimp activity, or survival sex. That's where minors sell sexual favors for either food or drugs. Bradford says a lack of education was one common factor leading to familial trafficking, but there was one more.
I knew that poverty obviously is an issue in Mississippi. It's an issue just about anywhere in any state that you have. We just happen to be at the bottom end of the barrel. And that's not a very popular answer, but it's true. It's just true.
A general lack of awareness of trafficking was pointed out as an issue. Bradford also says there were sympathy gaps among the officials who sat down to talk.
It was so clear that they were looking at teenagers as prostitutes, calling them those names.
Bradford says that was especially troubling because the people being questioned were the ones handling child sex trafficking cases.
You can't bring awareness to that. You can't open somebody's eyes to that. At the place where they were. And I wasn't sure even how to do that, so we didn't. We just cut the interview short.
The final report in Mississippi also points to cultural issues that make some families more prone to trafficking their own children. That doesn't appear to be a new topic.
You know, a few years ago, looking back, it was probably about 20 years ago.
That's Kelly Dorr again. Earlier, she described her experience as a victim of familial trafficking. She lives in Colorado. APR sought her out for an interview not just because she's a survivor, but what she did about it. Dorr currently helps write anti-trafficking legislation on the state and federal level. That interest was not only prompted by her own abuse, but by an experience she had as an undergrad in college. Dorr says she accompanied a professor to the Ozarks on a speaking tour.
And she was talking about that, you know, it's not normal to have sexual relations with members in your family. And, you know, if someone in your family has been abusing you or perpetrating on you, then, you know, what are your rights? You have the ability to report it to authorities and seek help.
Dorr says that's when the situation went a little sideways.
several of the women sort of got uncomfortable, and then they got up and started walking away.
Dor chased after them to ask what was wrong, and they told her.
In our culture and with our families, if you are a woman who is over the age of 16 and you have not been had by a male member of your family, you're not considered a woman.
Wendy Bradford agrees with the notion of culture playing a role in familial trafficking, but her point is that no one should consider this just a Southern thing.
Why wouldn't that kind of stuff occur with poverty? It happens on the other side of the world, in Cambodia. I visited Cambodia. The poverty over there, I mean, you are celebrated if you have a girl. So, because the girl's going to provide for you through trafficking.
But how does all of this figure into potential familial trafficking in Alabama? Bradford agrees that Alabama and Mississippi look a lot alike in terms of rural population, poverty, and a lack of education. All of these elements were pointed out in Mississippi's report as factors related to familial trafficking, but Bradford says that's not enough.
Unless someone is willing to pick up the torch and do the research and go through some type of thing like we went through and say, okay, so, hey guys, here are our statistics in Alabama. They told me we weren't going to move forward unless we had statistics, that we were not going to get support.
Back at the Human Trafficking Summit in Montgomery, Teresa Collier is getting ready to attend a few more talks before her afternoon breakout session on law enforcement. Once she wraps up here, it's back to her regular job and the tough sell she says she's been experiencing on familial trafficking.
I tell law enforcement and also the DAs, hey, this is a trafficking case, and whether they want to pursue that or not, most of the time they don't, because it's just easier to do a lesser type of charge, you know, just like a sex abuse or something like that. It's just easier for them.
The people here today who work with survivors of human trafficking say they deal with a general public that's largely uninformed about the issue. Then there are the stereotypes.
That's a great question, because I think there's a big misnomer.
We met Christian Lim earlier in our program. He's leading a team at the University of Alabama School of Social Work on projects related to human trafficking in the state.
Especially because of maybe some of the movies and videos that have been popular over the last 10 years or so.
And there's one Hollywood film people like Christian Lim love to hate.
I don't know who you are. I don't know what you want. If you are looking for ransom, I can tell you I don't have money. But what I do have are a very particular set of skills.
Lim says the movie Taken with actor Liam Neeson may be an exciting depiction of human trafficking, but that's all.
And that's why I mentioned that it's really more insidious than throwing a bag over somebody's head and throwing them in a van.
Here's how the FBI says trafficking works. For an adult to be a victim of trafficking, that person has to be forced into it. That happens through coercion, fraud, or deception. If an underage minor is involved in commercial sex, that young person is automatically considered a trafficking victim under the law.
He drugged me, and I woke up in a hotel room naked on a bed and had no idea how I got there or when or anything.
That's Ace. She's 19. That's not her real name, but that's how she wants to be called for this program. Ace was 16 when she was trafficked along the Mississippi Gulf Coast. That's the southwestern part of Alabama Public Radio's broadcast market. We met Ace at a cafe. We sat in a booth in a quiet corner as she talked about what happened to her 3 years ago.
I was being bullied really bad in school, and I had just found out I had cancer for the first time. So I had told my teachers and counselors, and they weren't doing anything about it. So I was like, I'm just going to meet somebody and see if I can go hang out with them for the weekend and then come back and be fine and go back to school. But they had other plans.
A report by Polaris, a human trafficking victim support group, says Ace isn't alone. Case data from the National Human Trafficking Hotline between 2015 and 2017 includes calls from over 800 victims who say they were recruited online. Ace says it started for her on a chat room.
You can post something and people can start a chat with you over it, which I had posted that I really needed someone to talk to because I was so depressed and I just I felt like I didn't have anyone to talk to back home.
Ace says someone who seemed sympathetic started chatting online. Then he suggested a face-to-face meeting. Remember, Ace was 16 at the time. One of her family saw her trying to sneak out and stopped her. More chatting followed. Then the second time, Ace got away and met this person in the parking lot of a big box store.
He kept asking if I had any siblings, and I wouldn't give that answer. And so it was kind of, like, I didn't think it was bad at the time, but looking back now on our conversation, I should have known that something wasn't right.
They pick up on that. It's almost like they are honed into that.
Sharon Robbins lives along the Mississippi Gulf Coast. She founded the advocacy group Jubilee Havens Ministry, which works with survivors of trafficking.
A trafficker or a pimp will actually find out your weaknesses by the way you're dressed or the way your personality is, like you're insecure or you need approval or you seem needy.
Robbins' expertise is no theory. She was trafficked herself in the late 1970s.
So, you know, me being already abused as a child, I had a lot of insecurities. I was an introvert. So, you know, they picked up on that.
Ace and Sharon Robbins represent two generations of trafficking victims. While Ace's pimp found her on the internet, the man who trafficked Robbins took a more personal approach. She left home as a teenager and started working in a cafe.
So he used the tactic of, well, I'm young, I'm 17, 18 years old. And I'm on my own, I'm living alone, and I need money, and maybe nobody's gonna miss me because my family doesn't even live in the same state. He found out all this information, you know, just by having breakfast every morning.
Promises of money and reassurance led to a job at the customer strip club. Robin says her trafficker used a combination of drugs and alcohol to get her up on stage. Then he said something that many victims of trafficking say they eventually hear.
Now I've done all this for you. I want you to do this for me. And this, because we need money.
That meant commercial sex.
Yeah, I had a couple of private instances where he would take me to a private room, you know, just to get to know me, find out a little bit more about my weaknesses prior to actually being sold. I think he was trying to feel me out to see how easy or how hard it was going to be.
Another thing both Robbins and Ace have in common is both were rescued. Robbins says she was back at the strip club one day when a family member showed up.
And he walked into the club, sat down at the front table, and I walked out on stage, and I was, of course, under the influence of alcohol, but when I saw him sitting there, I freaked.
Back at our cafe booth, Ace recalls how a routine traffic stop with her trafficker behind the wheel and her in the back seat led to her rescue. She's back home and the ordeal is over, except for the nightmares. One in particular.
I'll be at home and my family will be there and I'll be in my room because it's further down the hall and in the back, and I'll have my door closed, and I'll just be in there, and then I'll hear two gunshots and then my siblings screaming, so I'll run out of my room with my BB gun and I'll see the people that tried to sell me with my siblings, and they'll have a gun to their head, and I'll see my parents' bodies on the floor, and they'll grab me, and I'll be begging for them to let my siblings go and just take me.
Even for victims of trafficking who are rescued, some things don't go away. I'm Pat Duggins, Alabama Public Radio News. This program contains content of an adult nature. Parents may want to consider whether it's appropriate for all ages. Up to this point, we've been outlining the problem of human trafficking in Alabama. Now, let's look at what's being done about it.
Just a few little things. On the takedowns, let's go easy. I mean, we've got to go in there fast and surprise. Well, I mean,
Sergeant Trent Kempster is with the Tuscaloosa Police Department. He's briefing a roomful of about 30 law officers.
I'm not saying don't go in there easy like a baby. I'm saying go in there fast, quick, but let's watch what we say and how we say it. Let's mean what we're saying.
The group represents police in Tuscaloosa, as well as the nearby city of Northport, the University of Alabama, and the Tuscaloosa County Sheriff's Department. But you might not know that just by looking at them.
But like I said, I'm not in any way saying let's walk in there real slow and like pansies. I mean, let's get in there and mean business on what we're doing, but let's try to...
No one tonight is in uniform. The male officers are mostly in jeans and sneakers. Some are in T-shirts bearing the logos of sports teams, except for one. His has the Star Wars character Boba Fett on it. They all make up the West Alabama Human Trafficking Task Force, and tonight they're going hunting.
Last weekend, luckily, we didn't lose a single video. We actually had 2 to 3 videos of the deal on every single one.
The attire of the female officers and deputies is even more informal. The goal is to nab Johns looking to buy commercial sex, with the female officers taking turns posing as sex workers. But to hear Sergeant Kempster talk about it, this isn't a bunch of cops playing dress-up. Sometimes it means going into harm's way. We're bleeping the name of the officer involved since she works undercover.
Did an absolute fantastic job last week when that guy brought the gun in. I mean, that was quick thinking. That was good heads up. That was good thinking to even say, hey, take it back to the car. I don't feel comfortable with it. So thank you for doing that.
The camera should be on the other one.
Why don't we just try putting it back on the screen?
After the briefing at Tuscaloosa PD, everyone moves to a local motel. We won't say where, since this is an all-night undercover sting operation. An estimated 75% of the sex workers arrested in Tuscaloosa show signs of being trafficked.
She was one of the most traumatized young females that I think I've ever interviewed.
That's Tuscaloosa Police Lieutenant Darren Beams. He runs the task force. Beams used to work homicide. He recalls the one case that convinced him trafficking was worse.
She'd been in the trafficking world since she was 12. She had been forcibly raped since she was 12. She had a child when she was 16. That child, the baby, was placed into the microwave oven by a trafficker. He threatened to turn it on, so he kept her in that life.
The task force is about to net its first suspect of the night. One of the female officers is alone in a motel room as a potential John arrives to talk price. Four more members of the task force are standing outside the back door to the room. The handcuffs go on, and the first suspect is ushered out for booking. One observer for tonight's sting is Christian Lim. We described earlier how Lim is leading a human trafficking project at the University of Alabama's College of Social Work. He says he has something in mind that could be a new tool to aid both the people who try to help victims of trafficking along with the victims themselves.
The best practice, and what I've seen actually work, is when they're sitting down at the table along with law enforcement, along with mental health, along with, you know, probation and other people, working together to find a solution for this victim.
Christian Lim and his team are designing what's called the first ever internet database meant to be used by everyone involved with trafficking victims. That includes law enforcement, social service groups, and the victims. But Lim admits the database is the easy part. It's changing mindsets that gets tricky.
Yeah, it's a huge shift. And not just for law enforcement. It's a big shift for all of the partners involved.
Here's what Lim means by a big shift.
The shift is really understanding that your role is important and is essential, but so is the role of the person that I had previously been viewing as my adversary. That their role is essential and important in both justice and recovery and restoration.
Lim spent 14 years with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. For law officers like him, the shift means getting past the stereotype that cops catch the bad guys and social workers give them a hug.
It was hard.
Tuscaloosa Police Lieutenant Darren Beams.
It was when we first started training the department, we had a lot of officers resist the changing from a transitioning from a criminal approach to a victim approach.
A victim approach means establishing whether a sex worker was forced into it by a trafficker. If an underage minor is involved in the sex trade, they're automatically considered a victim of trafficking. Adults have to be coerced or lured in by fraud or deception. Lieutenant Beam says there's a catch.
A lot of them that are involved in commercial sex know the language that we're looking for.
In other words, people in handcuffs tend to lie.
But we still have a few clues, little things in our bag that we can, little tools in our bag that we can identify those that are not telling the truth.
But the notion of law enforcement working hand in glove with social workers has its supporters.
We can't do what we do without law enforcement. We can do probably about a quarter of it.
That's Crystal Yarbrough. She lives in Mobile. Yarbrough runs a shelter for people in the sex trade along the Gulf Coast, and she knows about the distrust between social workers and police.
A lot of times service providers are so victim-centered that they tend to be anti-law enforcement. Sometimes law enforcement is so law enforcement that they tend to be anti-victim services.
Yarbrough sees this world from an undercover operation of her own. Not far from downtown Mobile, we won't say how far, is a small house in a quiet neighborhood. We won't say which one. It's called the Rose Center.
And then this is our kitchen. And we serve one hot meal a day here.
Sex workers and victims of trafficking can sleep, eat, wash their clothes, and get counseling. That's why we're keeping the location a secret. Yarbrough doesn't want traffickers or former Johns showing up. She says the first stop for new clients is by the front door. It's a white cabinet with a padlock.
If the girls carry something on them, it's a knife. Sometimes they carry a gun for protection. Most of the time they don't bring them in with them, but we do ask them, if you do have it with you, we lock it up. Okay, this is our laundry room, and it's just a place for them to come, put their clothes in. We don't know when the last time they were able to wash and dry their clothes, and that was not in a hotel or coin-operated.
Yarbrough is already a believer in the idea of changing mindsets among law enforcement and caregivers when it comes to helping victims of sex trafficking. But not just so cops and social workers get along. Yarbrough says the victims benefit too.
They need to know that because they have been really manipulated to believe that law enforcement is against them, that they tend, you know, to already have that mindset. We want to change that mindset because we are all a community.
Yarbrough recalls one case that shows how traumatic being trafficked can be. The victim couldn't express how she was feeling through words. Yarbrough communicated with a sheet of paper with four boxes. The first box had a happy face drawn on it with words associated with being happy. The others had faces and words for sadness, fear, and anger.
She pointed to mad, sad, afraid, and then suspicious.
The Rose Center operates only two drop-in facilities in the U.S. The one we're visiting is in Mobile, which serves the Gulf Coast between Alabama and New Orleans. The second one is in Green Bay, Wisconsin, which represents a twist when it comes to changing mindsets. Yarbrough is referring to acceptance that there's sex trafficking going on in a given community. She says people in the Deep South respond differently from those in the Midwest.
In the Midwest, it's very much like, let's fix that. What can I do about that? In the South, it's very much like, oh, I wish you had not told me about that. Oh, I did not want to know that.
And as for announcing that the Rose Center would open in Mobile in the first place?
I don't think we really told a lot of people.
Back at the sting operation in Tuscaloosa, the arrests are trickling in. Without naming names, the list includes college-aged young people, one member of the military, and a trucker who left his 18-wheeler idling in the parking lot while he allegedly dropped in to buy sex. For Christian Lim, the next step is rolling out the University of Alabama's shared trafficking database. He says the goal is to make sure trafficking victims don't get lost in the cracks.
And so you have a system now that's working together to actually truly find justice and truly help this person towards restoration, as opposed to in the case of a defense attorney and a prosecuting attorney, a couple professionals that are looking to win a case.
And Lieutenant Beams and the West Alabama Human Trafficking Task Force will play a part in that. His team is being asked to help train state lawmen on how the task force operates. Beams says that includes his own officers who once opposed treating sex workers as possible victims of trafficking.
It was difficult to change the mindset. And across the state, I think it's still difficult because we're one of the only task forces running right now that are addressing it like we do.
Dealing with mindsets on the subject of human trafficking isn't limited to law enforcement and survivor support groups. I'm APR student reporter Tina Turner. There's another part of Alabama's population that appears especially vulnerable to being trafficked.
You know, I can feel every thump that went across his body, you know.
Billy Jack Gaither was finally dead.
About half a dozen students are gathered at Auburn University's campus in Montgomery. They're watching the documentary, Assault on Gay America. It tells the story of how Billy Jack Gaither of Alabama was beaten to death with an axe handle. The message is, in Alabama, violence against gay people is not a hate crime.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And Gaither's death appears far from forgotten.
Wonderful to see you all here this beautiful afternoon in Montgomery.
The crowd was bigger for this talk at the Alabama Capitol. Auburn professor Dr. Paul Hard organized today's 20th annual vigil for hate crime and violence. It was inspired by Gaither's murder.
If you're grateful for the nice weather and in spite of everything they were telling us, would you just say yes?
Yeah!
All right.
On one side of Dr. Hard is the flag of Alabama. On the other is the Rainbow Gay Pride flag. Despite his comments about the weather, the event and the documentary screening carry the same serious message. In Alabama, violence against gay people is not a hate crime. And Hard wasn't the only person who wanted to talk about it.
Today, I'm truly honored to be here at this event.
That's Darrenisha Duncan Boyd, a transgender woman of color. She's the CEO of a group called Alabama's Take that stands for Transgender Advocates, Knowledge, and Empowering.
I had to come in honor of 20 years for this vigil, but this is the best place to be at. Because oftentimes we know that trans women of color don't have a voice in the race.
The point of tonight's gathering is that violence against gay or transgender people needs to be considered a hate crime. But that's not Boyd's only concern.
Taking your money and doing what they want to do with you and all that other stuff.
We sat down with Boyd at Take headquarters in Birmingham, where the agenda is a little different. Take helps trans women of color, including those who work in the sex trade. That is something Darrenisha knows about.
Oh, girl, I was inside my house, and the first person, believe it or not, it was a lawyer.
Boyd performed sex acts for money.
So it was a great experience, and it wasn't, it was something different for me. Because he wasn't my ideal type of guy, but oh well, I made it work, and I made like over $400 plus $500 or whatever. So I wasn't, you know, complaining about it.
Boyd says she was never under the control of a pimp, but she says others in the LGBTQ community are.
Not being able to find stable income, stable housing, and to meet our basic daily needs. So you have to do something in order to survive.
This is where Boyd begins to address the issue of gay and transgender trafficking. For many teenagers, it starts with running away from home, typically over arguments with their parents. Boyd says being gay on top of being a teenager can complicate things.
A lot of youth are forced out of their homes, especially here, conservative, evangelical Christians and all that stuff in the red states or whatever. So if you're pushed out of the house from your family, you don't have support or whatever.
The human trafficking support group Polaris says 40% of homeless youths in the U.S. identify as LGBTQ. The FBI says if someone sells a minor for commercial sex, the law considers that young person to be a victim of trafficking. Homelessness is considered a key factor for young people who end up being trafficked. And Darrenisha isn't the only one trying to do something about it.
Like me, I was sold to both males and females. So, you know, I had to make a choice.
Lynn Caffrey lives in Huntsville, and she's a survivor of human trafficking.
Whenever I got my life changed, do I want to be straight? Do I want to be gay? So you have to really learn who you really are. And in a lot of ways, sometimes they don't know who they are when they're that young.
All right, this is our dining room. Now, at one point, we've leveled all the floors.
And in the Huntsville area, a lot of these young people come here.
So we had to level it to make it handicap accessible. This wasn't here. There was a door here.
Safe Harbor Youth is a transitional living program for runaways who are homeless, living on the streets, or victims of human trafficking. Caffrey is the executive director, and her clients run from 16 to 22 years old.
Most of our kids identify as bisexual, and that's because they've been sold to this person or that person, males and females, so they really don't know what their gender is.
Caffrey says teens who identify as transgender might have it the toughest when it comes to acceptance, particularly at home. But Caffrey has opinions of her own when it comes to LGBTQ young people living in a conservative state like Alabama.
Religion, Bible Belt, the South is so huge on it, okay? But if you look at the book, the Bible, it says, judge not and you shall not be judged.
Caffrey carries that message to Alabama's faithful.
Like when I speak in churches and stuff, I'm like, if you see a kid dressed in drag when you come to my house, don't judge them. That's not what you're coming there for. If you can't come there with an open mind and understand that they're humans, that they're just like me and you, but they have different sexualities. We're not here to judge them on their sexuality.
Especially the ladies that experience substance abuse, they basically, you know, they settle for this condition and not knowing that it's very toxic and it's dangerous.
Back at Take's office in Birmingham, Derenisha talks about the constant struggle to keep at-risk clients who also happen to be gay or transgender from falling in the trap of being trafficked. For Boyd, the story of one girl she knew comes to mind. She was 15 years old, pushed out of her home, who took up with a man in his 40s just to survive. Boyd says it doesn't take much for a situation like that to go very badly.
It's a risky business and it's very dangerous because you don't know if your next John will be, you know, the person that will kill you.
For me, really the message that I want you all to take back, to think about this, you're dealing with humans. These are human beings. It could be
Evelyn Chumbau is from Cameroon. She's also a survivor of labor trafficking.
Being a victim at such a young age, I have trauma, but think about that. It can be your child. It can be your sister. So,
I'm Stan Engold, Alabama Public Radio News. Chumbau told this panel of U.S. senators how she was brought to the United States from Africa. She expected to go to college. What Chumbau says she got was a life of slave labor. And before you ask, the state says it's happening here in Alabama.
We have children doing the job of an adult, and they don't have that level of safety that an adult would have.
Robin Wilburn is the Child Labor Inspector Supervisor for the Alabama Department of Labor. She's also a new member of the Alabama Human Trafficking Task Force. Wilburn says many undocumented children are forced into jobs upon arriving in the U.S.
And they're also doing jobs that you're long hours on their feet, cold conditions or very hot conditions. It just depends on what job they have.
Many of these children are working in meat processing plants, agriculture, and construction. Most are coming from Central America, Guatemala in particular. Wilburn says they first have to find false IDs to get these jobs.
One of my young girls that was working at the meat processing plant, she was fired after 2 days because somebody else was already using that name and Social Security number.
And when her bosses found out,
they told her to get new papers and come back.
Which sounds cheap and easy if you're okay with breaking the law. But Wilburn says it's not.
In interviews with them, they're paying anywhere from $1,000 to $5,000. I don't know who is the source that they get their IDs from, but most of the driver's licenses that we looked at were from neighboring states, Tennessee, North Carolina.
State Attorney General says four North Alabama massage parlors were fronts for human trafficking.
State raids on massage businesses in Huntsville made the news earlier this year, including this report on WAAY-TV.
Way 31 Sydney Martin has been digging through the court documents all day, getting reaction, in fact, from local businesses.
These are industries where sex trafficking and labor trafficking often overlap, just not clearly.
Labor trafficking is not necessarily sex trafficking. Sex trafficking is always labor trafficking.
Doug Gilmer is the resident agent in charge of Homeland Security investigations for the Birmingham Field Office. He says when it comes to breaking the two down, you must look at them individually. Here's step one.
The two main forms are sex trafficking, which is the facilitation of a commercial sex act through force, fraud, or coercion, or in which the victim is under the age of 18.
And defining labor trafficking is a little different.
Labor trafficking is another form of human trafficking, and labor trafficking is very similar and that it's the use of fraud, force, or coercion to employ, harbor, transport, otherwise exploit a person for the purpose of forced labor, slavery, debt bondage, peonage, that kind of thing.
Peonage is where people work off a debt with labor, Congress outlawed the practice in 1867, but it's reportedly going on now in Alabama. Immigrants trying to make a new life for themselves cross paths with people looking to exploit their situation. Gilmer says many of these people are working in plain sight.
There are industries in which there doesn't necessarily have to be a lot of skilled labor. It could be housekeeping at a hotel. It could be dishwashers at a restaurant, cooks. Could be the agricultural industry, manufacturing, those types of things.
This is where the Alabama Board of Massage Therapy comes in. Keith Warren is the executive director of the board.
We have approximately 50 out of the 709 that we have licensed as massage therapy establishments, or that calculates to 7% of those that are out there that we've identified and participating in that type of activity.
Some breaking news right now out of Jupiter, Florida. Police there have just announced that the owner of the New England Patriots, Robert Kraft, has been charged with soliciting prostitution.
The courts are still sorting out the high-profile case in Florida against New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft. It can be argued that alleged Johns know what they're looking for. I asked Warren how sex workers end up in situations like this. His answer may come as a shock.
The information that we've obtained during the investigations is that the conditions that they are presented with and given when they are here are tremendously greater than the conditions that they have where they originally came from.
These businesses are often a front for human trafficking, but in Alabama, the Massage Therapy Board is very active in fighting back.
We are probably one of the very few states out of all 50 that have the authority to go in and inspect an establishment without having an official complaint filed against them. So we are pretty much the lead in the nation on being able to go after these type of complaints.
Those fighting traffickers know the best way to stop the process is to take away their means of carrying out their practice. The state of Alabama has a new tool that helps in this effort, as well as offering another way to help the victims.
It's not too far akin to what we see in the forfeiture side for criminal cases.
That is Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall. His office came up with a new law that's designed to fight traffickers and help victims at the same time by giving state prosecutors a specific power.
To allow us in a civil setting to seek very immediate relief through a temporary restraining order and then subsequently a preliminary injunction when we are aware of a business that it either has been, is, or will be engaged in human trafficking.
We continue to follow breaking news at this hour in West Huntsville. Federal law enforcement agents just wrapped up a search at the health massage parlor that's off University.
Before, prosecutors could only charge traffickers with a crime. Now the victims can hit massage business owners in their wallets. Marshall says the cases in Huntsville are the first time the state has been able to use the new law.
It's a wonderful tool for us to then not only seek that immediate relief, shut down a business or businesses that we believe are engaged in this effort, and then allow the civil courts to be able to allow that case to continue.
Liz, deputies and federal law enforcement agents were going in and out of this health massage parlor right behind me just about a few hours ago.
Just last week, Marshall's office hosted a summit where they took what authorities have learned in Alabama and passed it along to others.
The largest law enforcement gathering every year is one that we host for training. You know, we have the opportunity to set the agenda, and one of the agenda blocks this year will be human trafficking, so that we'll bring in some experts. Gives us a chance to broaden the knowledge, expand the training, and hopefully create more opportunities for enforcement.
All of the law enforcement individuals that we spoke to say they're trying to help the victims. Once someone is taken out of a trafficking situation, they then try to help them get some stability in their lives. Robin Wilburn with the Alabama Department of Labor says this is especially true when working with kids.
The teenager is not in trouble. We're not prosecuting them. And that's why a lot of times they're willing to answer our questions, because we've reiterated to them that they are not being held responsible. No penalty will be issued to them. And we also do not deport. We're not immigration.
Hey guys, I know it's 6 o'clock, but we are going to give it about 5 more minutes because I did get a message that there is a wreck outside. So I'll kind of give some people a few more minutes to get in before we get started.
We're in an auditorium at City Hall in the town of Northport, just across the Black Warrior River from Tuscaloosa. Police Sergeant Ashley Blaylock is working to corral a room full of parents.
Yes.
Volunteers at the check-in table hand out plastic cups and souvenir wristbands. The whole scene looks like a PTA meeting until you hear what's on the minds of the crowd.
Okay, my name is Keisha Grice, and I'm from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. How long does it take for the pimps to build that relationship with the victims before they actually make their move and bring them into sex trafficking?
My name is Laura Jernigan, and I'm from Tuscaloosa. My question would be, electronics being allowed in the school, that allows kids access that they wouldn't otherwise have. What do we do about that?
Tonight is a town hall on trafficking. The cups and wristbands are stamped with the logo of the West Alabama Human Trafficking Task Force.
All right. Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. We're going to go ahead and get started, and we may still have some coming in. My name is Sergeant Blaylock. I'm with Northport Police Department. I'm sure many of you have spoken to.
Sergeant Blaylock is part of the task force, and she's tonight's moderator.
But I want to go ahead and introduce you guys to my team. Down at the very end is the kind of heads.
Keisha Bryant asked, how long does it take for a trafficker to lure a young person in? The task force says anywhere from 2 weeks to a month. Laura Jernigan's question on gadgets in school relate to online chat rooms the traffickers use to contact young people to begin with. Sergeant Blaylock says that's a subject that hits home.
I'm actually, by the grace of God, not one of the victims that we've come in contact with.
Blaylock says police can't tell principals what to do about student cell phones, but she knows how traffickers work online to draw kids in.
I was that kid that growing up in middle school, I played on the internet, I talked to strangers, you know, I had these relationships that we're telling people don't have.
Human traffickers, and I've said this, but they manipulate the victims into thinking that they're looking for a genuine relationship and or romance. They buy them gifts, and then they ultimately...
We chose to end our program here, not over the questions and answers, but because tonight there's a guest speaker.
This is now the time that we're going to dismiss all the kids, and they're going to go to the hallway for pizza. So this conversation is going to be just for the parents. So I promise we have pizza and drinks outside in the hallway for you. I promise there's lots of officers outside making sure that your kids are okay. All right, so this right here, I'll let her introduce herself, but this is Dixie. She is a human trafficking survivor.
If Dixie Shannon's name sounds familiar, it could be because she led off our program. The Central Alabama resident was trafficked twice, first at the age of 17 and again in her mid-20s.
I guess I have a few minutes to talk to you guys about my story. Anything about my past, it was an embarrassment, it was a shame, it was condemnation, it was just a lot of negativity. So I was just basically suffering.
Afterwards, we caught up with Shannon to see how the night went.
I think it went good. It was the first time I've ever spoke to family or to parents, so I would like to have had more time with them. I would have liked to have had more Q&A with them, but I think it went really good.
And not just for the audience. Shannon says tonight's talk was good for her as well.
Because I have my oldest kids that I have really not been able to sit down like with them about human trafficking, so it was good practice for me to have for my children.
Shannon's children were growing up during the second time she was trafficked, and when the time for that talk comes up, she says she thinks she'll be ready. The theme music for our program is Forgotten by Martinez Lauer. I'm Pat Duggins. For Stan Ingold, Tina Turner, and all of us at Alabama Public Radio, thanks for tuning in.